Naturally Speaking.
Hi, so you're listening to the latest edition of the Naturally Speaking podcast. I'm James Grecian, and I'm here today joined by James Buckley.
Hello.
And by Sean Killen.
Hello.
This is going to be our second edition of a research roundup.
Yeah.
Where we're going to be talking about a couple of the papers, or three papers that have been recently, and recently is kind of a broad term, produced...
In 2012.
From the Graham Co. Yeah, in 2012.
Well, related to that, maybe we should talk a little bit about our summer schedule here.
Or lack of.
Speaking, or lack of a schedule, yes.
Yeah, I'm going on holiday.
Yeah, well, it's been hard to get us all in the same place, basically. We originally planned to do these once every couple of weeks or so, but this is our first one in, what, about a month?
I think we're going to put a clause around that saying, during the term time.
Yeah.
Outside of term time, it does seem to be quite hard to get us all around and in the same room at the same time. And we haven't yet learned how to record across continents. So when we do, then you'll be hearing from us every couple of weeks. But
when Naturally Speaking goes international.
Yeah, exactly.
Internationally.
Internationally speaking. That doesn't
nice.
Work. That doesn't work at all. But
anyway, should we get down to the matter at hand here? The research roundup?
I suppose we should, shouldn't we?
Yeah, yeah. We should. Another thing we should say here is we got a lot of interesting papers to talk about. One of the ones I found to be really interesting was a paper looking at sex-specific foraging in birds, which James Grecian was actually part of, and he felt...
What a coincidence.
Yeah, well, he felt a little bit weird about talking about it on the podcast, and so he didn't want to do it, but I thought it sounded really cool, and so I thought we should talk about it. But what we're going to do is take advantage of the fact that he's on the paper. We're going to do a little experiment here where I'm going to actually summarize and present the paper, and James is going to tell me all about how wrong I was about everything after.
Pretty much.
I thought it'd be a cool experiment in sort of, you know, seeing how other people perceive your work when it's been released. So.
Yes, indeed. Yeah, that's it.
So do we want to start with that one then, or do we want to...
I think that sounds good.
All right.
Yeah.
Okay,
Sean, so what's my paper about?
Yeah. Well, so this is some work that you did with collaborators. The paper's by Stouse et al.
Yep.
It was in Marine Ecology Progress series. And as I mentioned, looking at sex-specific foraging behavior in northern gannets. And I hadn't really known much about this sex-specific foraging behaviors. But it sounds really cool. What's that?
I thought they all did the same thing.
Well,
but obviously not.
No, apparently in a lot of different... is it most of this work been done in birds then? Or is this carry across taxa?
I think it carries across taxa. I mean, my PhD was mainly focused on northern gannets. So that's why, hence the paper.
Well, the general idea about the sex-specific foraging is that, males and females have different foraging behaviors or food preferences. And I guess a lot of that relates to breeding activity, and that especially in species that have parental care, the male and females end up having different duties, and then that influences their foraging activity and the types of foods that they might prefer. So if females that produce eggs, maybe they're going to need certain types of food that allows them to produce the highest quality eggs. So most of this work, as I mentioned, has been done during the breeding season, because that's when a lot of these differences will really come out, when the parents have different duties. But there hasn't been a lot to look at sort of whether or not these differences persist into the non-breeding season, or if they exist different life stages, so in immature individuals that aren't even breeding yet, for example. Yeah. So that's what James and his group were interested in looking
at. It's not my group, just for the record. It's my supervisor's group.
His collaborators and colleagues were interested in looking at in the northern gannets. Because the other neat thing now, too, is that we're only just starting to get the technology available to look at some of these questions, where you can actually attach little GPS loggers and things to birds, really small ones, which doesn't...
They're getting smaller and smaller, aren't they?
But yeah.
I don't know what the sizes are, what the weights and sizes are now. They must be tiny, aren't they?
Well, the small tags that we used to look at overwintering behavior were a couple of grams. A
couple of grams, there you go.
Wow. Very small. So you guys used a combination of these using GPS loggers and also radioisotopes or stable isotopes. Basically look at the feeding history of these animals, and also sort of where they go while they're foraging. And so you guys looked at gannets in a breeding colony, to start off with, put GPS loggers on them, and basically just tracked where they would go when they're out on their foraging bouts, because they nest in cliffs, and then they go out to sea to feed, right? They collect food, and you were looking to see if males and females differ in sort of where they go while they're foraging.
And also what they collect? or just more to where they went?
Where they go, what they feed on, because you might expect them to assume different roles.
Okay.
Because they're, I mean, one of the things people have looked at before is in sexually dimorphic species that there are different foraging roles due to maybe size. But in gannets, they're sexually monomorphic, so they're very, very similar in size.
Mm.
So they might assume different roles due to sex differences, or they may not. They may do the same thing.
Come on, who's summarizing your paper here?
Sorry.
No, but you're also using the stable isotopes to get an idea of their feeding history as well, right? So looking at in their feathers, and then in the immature individuals, their blood as well, to see what they've been eating in the short term and also the longer term.
So that the function of radioisotopes was to use to
stabilize isotopes.
Stabilize. Yeah. Get myself.
So non-radioactive isotopes.
Because based on what they've been feeding on, they can get different ratios of carbon or nitrogen isotopes.
Is that based on what they feed in the food chain?
In terms of the food chain, where they're picking their prey from in terms of the trophic level.
Okay.
But also from the carbon isotopes, you can get an idea of where they're foraging as well, because a lot of their carbon ratios are related to phytoplankton abundances, ultimately, and that varies spatially from shore.
Oh, cool.
So you can get an idea of how much they're eating in terms of near shore, offshore, that type of thing.
Pretty clever then.
Yes. And so you were logging these birds, tracking them, during the breeding season, but then also in the non-breeding season, so overwintering when they would migrate down south, like to Africa. And then also you were tracking immature individuals? Were you with GPS loggers as well?
With satellite tags. So the problem with juveniles is that they don't come back to the colony. So these are immatures that hang around club sites at the colony.
Mm-hmm.
And
clubs, like?
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, pretty much. So they just, they turn up, they kind of hang out, they chill out, they kind of see what's going on, and they go off foraging. But what we don't really know is how their foraging patterns differ to adult birds. So we had a paper out a couple of years ago looking to see how different they are. Because you might expect them to hang around colonies, kind of pick up clues on where food might be,
mm-hmm.
to go and forage and kind of learn these kind of behaviours over the long time that they have to mature to adulthood. It's like 4 or 5 years before they become breeding birds.
Yeah. No, it's very cool. So what did you actually find? Well,
what did I find?
So for the breeders, so during the breeding season, when you compare the males and females, the females spent more time foraging away from the colony. So if you look at the very cool maps in the paper, you can see these traces of where the birds were actually going. I understand you made those maps, James.
I did.
So it's interesting that the females seem to travel further away from the nest sites than the males. The males, on the other hand, stick closer to the breeding colony, and I guess based on their stomach contents and the isotopes, you infer that they spent more time, or they ate fishery discards more than the females, so they're sort of scavenging around more than the females were.
Why might that be?
Well,
this is just in the paper, or do we need to turn to our...
Well, there was some interesting...
in front of us.
Well, there's some interesting hypotheses put forward. There's potential that males were better able to compete for spots behind fishing boats.
Okay.
Because if you see fishing boats out to sea, like a lot of times they're just absolutely mobbed with birds following them. So maybe the males were a little bit more competitive there. But also, because the males tend to defend their nests, maybe they just have to stick closer to shore.
Okay.
And maybe the females prefer more oily dietary items like mackerel and things, so they have to go out further to shore where the discards are mostly whitefish, which
the
don't
males
have.
Just, males just get whatever they can to...
Yeah,
to
maybe they don't have such strong preferences there.
Okay.
Or maybe they're just lazier. That wasn't mentioned in the paper, but that's...
It's kind of... We had a couple of articles that suggested that maybe, like news articles that were kind of picking up the fact that males and females do something different. And maybe the males are just lazy compared with the females that have to work harder for food.
Okay.
But, I mean, the females have to, they're investing more in the reproductive effort. I mean, they're producing the eggs.
Mm-hmm.
And although for gannets are quite large, the eggs are quite small, so the egg development might not be that costly, but it's certainly the case that they may have slightly different nutritional requirements as a result.
Yeah.
So yeah, so they forage much further off, and they forage on what you might call more natural food sources, whereas gannets, male gannets seem to rely much more heavily on the discards, which are maybe slightly easier to target.
Well, and that's really interesting too when you get into the implications of the sex-specific foraging behavior, because if you have, you know, the males and females foraging different areas, preferring different food items, when it comes to things like environmental change, you could get different sexes being affected in different ways. And when it comes to something like discards, if you guys mentioned in the paper that, you know, if there are regulations imposed on discards, these discards make up a fairly heavy proportion of the males' diets, like up to 20% or something, I think it was. if all of a sudden that's eliminated or altered in some way, then you could have impacts there on one gender, but not the other. It's sort of interesting. It's very interesting. But then, so how did these differences carry over into the non-breeding season? You found no evidence that these differences persisted. So after they're finished breeding, there was no other differential effects in their foraging behavior. And with the immature individuals, there was no differences between sexes either. So it seems to be really related to their breeding activities.
Okay.
So yeah. So
essentially, you're saying that males are simpler and lazier than females in gannets.
That would be one way of describing it.
Only in gannets, though.
Only in gannets. Well, I think many people would dispute that.
Okay, so no, I thought that was a very cool paper. So how was the summary overall?
It's pretty good. Yeah, I can't really dispute that. I mean, one of the problems we would say with the tags is that GPS tags, so the tags that we're using to track birds during the breeding season, are really, really high resolution. So that's maybe 20 meters resolution. Mm-hmm. Because it's the same technology that's in your GPS in your car, for example, mm-hmm. or on your phone. But the geolocators, these GLS tags, that we use to track the overwintering, they're better in that the batteries last much longer, but they're much poorer resolution. So the resolution's maybe 200 kilometers.
Okay.
So I mean, in the paper, we map the distributions, and they're pretty much exactly the same, the overwintering distributions of West Africa.
Mm.
The shape of the distribution is the same, just looking at kernels of where the birds are going.
Okay.
But because the resolution is quite poor, you might find that there are differences or nuances on the small scale.
Okay. Is that something you guys are...
It's something that would
future,
be great to
but
do,
it's technological.
Technologically, yeah. At the moment, it's not really possible.
So, shall we move on to?
Well, we could cover fish. I mean, if you're going to cover birds this week, maybe I could.
That
talk
sounds
to you,
good.
Talk to Sean, the local fish expert, about sticklebacks.
And correct me if I'm wrong. This is a
sticklebacks
paper.
Are not a fish, actually. No, it's kidding.
Just the same as gannets aren't birds. So this is a paper that Hu Sung Lee published in Ecology this year, along with Pat Monahan and Neil Metcalf in the department. And this was looking at the pattern of early growth trajectories and how they may affect adult breeding performance. So it's an interesting idea, and it's not something that I'm too familiar with, but it's the idea that that how your resources as a juvenile, how you allocate those resources may affect your long-term survival and your long-term fitness. So they looked at sticklebacks because, as along with many fish, they're ectotherms, and so they grow in relation to the ambient temperature. So a lot of their previous work that's looked at how growth trajectories may affect breeding performance have manipulated food supply. Mm. But the problem with that is that you may have metabolic changes as a result of being starved or feasting. So what they've done instead is they've controlled food supply, but then manipulated temperature, which allows to see how growth may be affected independent of nutritional stress.
Yeah.
And this is quite interesting because there may be costs associated with being small. So if you manipulate the growth rate of a fish so that it grows to be quite small, then that might increase its predation risk or reduce its reproductive success. But by being small and by maybe having a lower metabolic rate, you may actually have a longer survival. So your lifespan may be increased. Contrary to that, there may be little benefit to growing large, although it may decrease your reproductive or increase your reproduction, but decrease your predation. So sticklebacks may have compensatory, or other fish may have these compensatory mechanisms that mean that if you starve fish when they're young, or if you change their temperature, they may try and compensate their growth rates to try and reach an optimal size that kind of natural selection has gone for. But the key is that the consequences of these kind of growth trajectories are relatively unknown in the literature, especially using temperature rather than food supply. So in this paper, they've taken wild caught sticklebacks, and they've stuck them in tanks, I guess, downstairs in the Graham Kerr building.
Yeah.
Which you'll be quite familiar with.
Yeah, very familiar with. Yeah.
And they've altered the growth trajectory. So they've taken juvenile fish that they've caught in the wild, and they've grown them in tanks. And they've altered these growth trajectories independent of food supply using temperature. And they also altered the photo period. So this was a way of manipulating the perceived time to the breeding season. So if you take a juvenile fish, you put it in either a high temperature so it can grow quite quickly, or a slow temperature so it can grow quite slowly. But then you also mess around with what time of year it thinks it is.
Were they doing, so they're doing like spring and autumn, so the sort of the long...
Yeah, so they were taking
short.
Them and delaying them by a month so that they thought, so the fish perceived an extra month before they were going to be reaching breeding condition, and so that can change the slope of that growth trajectory, if you like.
That's very cool.
It's really, really interesting research. And then once the fish got to the actual breeding season, they then measured reproductive performance to see how those how manipulating the early stages in the life cycle may actually affect breeding performance. And they looked at throat coloration and the ability to build nests in stickleback, because one of the cool things with the male stickleback is that they display, they have these bright red throats, but then they also build these little teepees underwater to try and impress the females.
Watching them build their nests and do their courtship is actually really, really quite amazing. I think Husung actually has some videos on YouTube. I'll write him an email and then maybe we can post links on the site, because they're very cool, like on our blog site.
I did not realize they built teepees.
Yeah. They're really cool little tents, like.
Well, the way you do it in the lab, normally they would collect weeds and things like that to build their nest. And they actually produce this glue from their kidneys, the males.
From their kidneys?
Yeah. It's called spigene. And they use this glue to stick it all together. And they basically swim through. They make a little tunnel in the pile of glued sticks and things. And they try and get the female to pass through it and lay their eggs. And then they go behind and fertilize. The males are extremely aggressive.
They guard that.
It did seem a little harsh in this, though, because obviously it was, you know, done under controlled conditions. Yeah. So they put the males in a little beaker with a little petri dish worth of sand and some threads to make their nest out, and then just showed them a female in a separate tank.
Yeah, well,
so this poor thing's like bashing its head against the side of the.
You cut a piece of thread to give it for the nesting material, and then you'll put a female in a beaker or something like that. And put it in the tank, and the males just go nuts. They go crazy. And then
what does the female do? Just sit there and go?
Swims up and down the glass. Like, I don't know, it all depends.
Looking a bit not bothered by the whole thing?
No, she reciprocates a bit, but there's, there's the glass there. Must be quite frustrating.
I can imagine, frustration or frustrated stickleback.
But you normally do that. I think you have to do that a couple times a day. For a few days before the males will actually start to build a nest.
They were saying that the coloration can last for up to 4 months.
Yeah,
so they really get properly the bright red throat.
Their throats get really bright red, and their eyes turn really bright blue. Really striking to look at. So you can really see when a male is in the mood.
So they took these males, and then they took photos of them to try and look at the coloration in the throats. And then they measured, and for the females, they then measured the number of eggs. So they took out the egg mass from the gravid females and measured or weighed the amount of eggs that were produced compared to the female body rate, because obviously you need to control for size, because larger females may produce larger eggs just because they're bigger. Hmm. And it's quite interesting what they found. I mean, they kind of matched the hypotheses that they were predicting they might find. So fish in the lower temperature groups increased their growth rates, so they tried to compensate, and fish in higher temperature then reduced their growth rates. And what they then did after they did that first period is they then put them in a standard temperature for the breeding experiment, and you found that although you got this separation in the early stages with fish in higher temperature growing quicker and slower in the lower temperature, they actually then matched. So once they got to the same temperature, the fish were normally the same size. So the fish got to similar size, but they'd actually had to do this compensation in the early stages. And sure enough, those fish that had had to compensate in low temperatures in the earlier life and so had accelerated their growth trajectory had reduced reproductive performance following the following two seasons. So males, they had a reduced sexual ornament, so the idea of these red throat colorations, and they were also slower at building nests, so they were kind of a little bit retarded in their nest building skills.
Oh dear.
And the females that have been growing in these higher temperatures produce many more eggs than in the lower temperatures. So there certainly seemed to be a cost to this compensatory growth at early stage that lasted over.
Oh, so both males and females were growing at the same temperatures as well. So,
They tried to do it over two seasons to look for long-term carryover effects, but the problem with that is that sticklebacks don't live for very long. So I think by the time they got to the second breeding season, so that, you know, a year and a half after this, or a year and just over a year after the experiment had started, they'd lost maybe 50, 60, 70% of the population.
I think the sticklebacks here, they typically only have one or two breeding seasons, two if they're lucky.
So it's really key, like how you grow and the conditions that you experience when you're young in the case of sticklebacks, really, really key in your long-term. long-term for a stickleback, it's long-term.
Yeah, no, definitely. They have to maximize their growth in a limited amount of time. But the whole compensatory growth thing is really interesting because, these fish, or actually it's been found in other groups as well, if something is deprived of food for a little while, or in this case, if they're exposed to a colder temperature, their growth rate, once they resume normal conditions again, is way faster than it normally would be, which is just a really cool thing. It's like, why don't they grow that fast all the time?
It's like they're trying to maintain a certain level.
I guess it's metabolic stress to an extent, isn't it? Yeah. Because when you're growing fast, you produce a lot of free radicals, and those free radicals go into damaged tissues. So although fast growth might be good in some cases, if it affects your long-term survival by, you know, giving you cancer, for example.
And can fast growth also mess up things like, you know, the functioning of muscles?
That's possible. I mean, one of the things that has been found with these fish, for example, is that these fish that grow really fast don't seem to be able to swim quite as well. So we're not really sure why at this point. That's one of the things that we're trying to figure out. Is there actually differences in the muscle quality there? Is there something different about it? Maybe it's like building a house really fast. You know, you get it built, but once you start looking at the details of it, it's not quite as, potentially. So, and then there's the costs here that are in this paper as well in terms of reproductive success. But, I mean, the point is that they got there. So there's sort of an optimal position there in that trade-off.
Yeah, really interesting work. So now we'll move on to, rather than doing the switch on specialist subjects, we're going to get James to talk about plants, which is somewhat closer to home.
This is somewhat closer to home.
You don't hear enough about plants.
No, there's not that many people looking at plants in this institute, but this is a...
You're fighting for the plants.
Barbara Mabel has been doing so for many years, and this is a paper by Annabelle Hawdry, who was in the department and has now moved on to other things, along with a few other people who are a few other past colleagues from the institute. And they were looking at sort of the genetic causes and sort of consequences of changes in mating system in this North American, well, it's a very widespread plant species, but they're focusing on the North American species, the Arabidopsis lyrata. It's a very close relative of the model sort of genetic plant in the world, which is Arabidopsis thaliana. And these are very small, quite insignificant looking plants with small white flowers. I've been in the field to see them, and this time of year particularly, they don't look much, but they are very interesting model systems for studying the genetics and ecology and understanding how those two link.
So is this when you were out in the field, was it 2 weeks ago out in Canada, with these similar plants that you
looked at? These are the exact same populations, which Barbara's been looking at for sort of many years, going to the same places. Mm. And these are perennial, so they keep on coming back in the same places.
Okay.
So you can go back to the same spot and sample those same, similar or closely related plants repeatedly.
Cool.
Quite handy. Mm. But the most interesting thing, so flowering plants, people don't often appreciate, they are immensely diverse, but also they're not only diverse in terms of the flowers that they have, the morphology and the colour, but also in terms of how they mate with other plants, their mating systems. So one of the most interesting, in my opinion, sort of changes is that between the choice to mate with yourself, you know, just mating with yourself. No, this is not
my... We're talking plants.
Talking plants here. Not talking for plants. Me, yeah, sorry. Mating with yourself or mating with others.
Eternal question.
So the idea of selfing versus...
Selfing versus outcrossing is the sort of the
we'll sit terminology. To save the confusion with you on your Friday night.
Oh dear. This is good. Anyway, this plant they're looking at, in this sort of region, it's a North American region, it's around the Great Lakes in North America. There's various populations differ in the number of individuals that actually like to self or outcross. So there's some populations are predominantly full of individuals that like to self, and some are predominantly full of individuals that like to mate with other individuals. So you end up with this sort of like very different variation in mating system around this region. And this is caused by, people know the region of the genome which causes this. And they know there's a particular thing called the S locus, the self-incompatibility locus. So when that's working well, then basically it prevents plants mating with themselves. It sort of says, this is self-pollen. If pollen, so you get male pollen, you get self-pollen from that plant. If it gets onto its own sort of, you know, other flowers on the same plant, that plant will go, I don't want to do this. This is not for me. Mm. And essentially stop any sort of fertilization occurring. But it allows, therefore, these plants to mate with other ones. So it forces them to outcross. But if this system, this genetic system, breaks down, you end up with this shift towards selfing. You can end up with a gradual change towards selfing. And there's other changes associated with it, as well as this genetic change, but you end up with this change towards selfing. This paper was looking essentially at some of the genetics of this, but I won't go into too massive amounts of detail, but they're looking at a range of sort of genetic markers across the genome, but also adjacent to this particular genetic locus, this genetic locus associated with this change in sort of mating system. And they basically showed that when you get this shift towards selfing, as opposed to mating with others, you end up with a reduction in sort of genetic diversity across the genome at these various markers, but also at this particular locus. It's basically, it's essentially inbreeding.
Yeah.
And you get risks such as inbreeding depression. You get the risk of sort of like bad things happening to these plants.
You reduce your genetic.
Exactly.
So you were saying that the different populations differ in the proportion of self-fertilizing individuals. Are there some environments where it just doesn't matter? Maybe ones that are...
Yeah, this transition, I said, it is remarkably common. There's a lot of plants and related plants that some that which are sort of will only mate with others. They're self, what you term self-incompatible. And some species, whole species are just completely able to self themselves. Mm-hmm. But this it's very hard. People don't know what really is causing this. They don't, for example, in this species, Arabidopsis loati, we don't, I'm studying a bit of this at the moment, but loads of work has been done on this, and you still don't know the exact genetic, you don't know the exact genetic changes that associated with this shift to selfing. We know it's something to do with that locus, but you don't know exactly what's happening there. And also you don't know, it seems to be associated with such a wide range of sort of ecological sort of disturbance, perhaps, or colonizing new areas. So there's multiple theories why it's happening, but no one's quite been able to tease them apart yet. So it's probably, as in most cases, a combination of factors, such as reproductive assurance. So if you're colonizing a new environment, you might just go, those that actually can mate with themselves are much more sort of
safe. So is it a speed thing, for example? So you think about aphids, like an aphid, you know, they turn up on a new plant and the female's just self and self and self and self and self.
Yeah.
To massively colonize the plant, they destroy the plant, and then it's only then that they'll then produce winged aphids to go off and mate.
That's sort of a very popular theory, there's other reasons as well where it might happen, and the thing is that it's because this genetic system is very complicated that controls the self incompatibility. Once it disappears, once it breaks down, it's very hard to get it back. So the transition that you see most commonly is from plants mating, so plants being self-incompatible, mating with other plants in the population, going to mating with just themselves. So you end up with that transition being the really, really common, but not the other way. Okay. And it's all why I think in some families, almost half the plants are self-compatible, half the species are self-compatible.
So have people done experiments, like competition experiments, where you put selfing individuals and cross-fertilizing ones in a common environment and see which ones kind of take over?
Well, this is quite a nice system in which to do that, because it's variation within a species. Often it's variation between species, so you're confounding a lot of things when you try and do competition experiments. But undoubtedly, it would probably be one factor. What's interesting is, for example, the effect that this selfing, or essentially inbreeding, has, and this reduced genetic variation across genome effect has an ability to colonize new environments and also cope with the invasion of other species, or cope with outcrossing relatives as well. How will that affect that? More work needs to be needed to actually study that.
So does that do it for another edition of Research Roundup?
I think one important thing to say is that if you have a paper coming out very soon, then we'd be very keen to hear about it, because I think it'd be really nice to get a very broad range of research from across the Institute.
And we'll take an August break, but when we come back in September, October, our first few, it'd be great to have some papers to talk about.
Or if you don't want to have us babbling on about your paper on here, if you want to come on and chat with us, either in an interview or just
casual format, that'd be great, actually.
Yeah. All right. So for another edition of Naturally Speaking, thank you. Over and out.
Bye.
Bye.
Over and out.
Renew.
Thanks for listening to the Naturally Speaking podcast. If you've got any ideas for future shows or want to get involved, then please contact us. We'd love to hear from you. Our email address is naturallyspeakingpodcast@gmail.com. Naturally Speaking is a podcast from the Institute of Biodiversity, Animal Health and Comparative Medicine at the University of Glasgow. For more information, you can find us on Facebook, you can find us on Twitter @thenspodcast, and you can download future episodes and find more information at our blog at naturallyspeakingpodcast.wordpress.com.
Hello.
Testing 1, 2, 3.
Okay, who wants to start?
My name's James.
Hi. So you're listening to the Naturally Speaking podcast. My name's James Grecian. You might have known me from previous iterations of the endings, but today we're actually going to be talking, and I'm going to be involved.
That's good. Do that. Do it again.